Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. On this episode, we'll be talking to William Viney, who's written a new book called Waste, A Philosophy of Things, which is published by Bloomsbury in 2014. Cool. So, welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm really delighted this week, or this episode, to have William Viney with us. He's going to be talking about Waste, A Philosophy of Things, which is his latest book, published by Bloomsbury in 2014. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave.
And it'd be good to start off with a bit of background, both about yourself. You're currently at Durham in the Department of English and Medical Humanities, and you're a Leverhulme fellow there.
That's right.
But also a bit about the background of the book as well.
Well, the book is a long time in the making, and I never really know when to begin these sorts of biographies, but maybe the quick way of saying how I got to be writing this book begins at Sussex University, and it begins by doing a joint honours degree in English literature and development studies being PPE in the so-called developing world. And that allowed me to read a lot of Marx, and it led me to read a lot of critical cultural theory, and it let me read economics. And that was so important in giving me a kind of sense of what kind of work I really enjoy doing, which was, you know, in the end, kind of capacious. I like capacious subjects. And I then did a master's in English studies at Durham, and that reminded me that I, as much as I like being a kind of literary critic, or the idea of being a literary critic, there is something intensely restrictive to when your subject is bounded by a particular media. So I decided I wanted to do a PhD. I did a master's thesis on waste in the work of J.G. Ballard, and I decided that I wanted to do a PhD on this thing we call waste. I thought that had more legs. And so I came to London, and I ended up doing a PhD in Cultural Studies Humanities at the London Consortium. And there I was encouraged to just write and to follow my chosen object of study into all the places it's ever been. And that was terrifying and liberating at the same time. So what, if this book is anything, then it's a testimony to a sort of delirious through few years kind of coursing through various London libraries, finding out about where waste resides and what it's done and what it's meant to different kinds of people.
Because it's at once very eclectic in the examples you range across and some of the thinkers, but also it has a relationship to, I guess, what for me was the sort of traditional field of literature. It's interesting you managed to combine the two. So people like Eliot or Joyce juxtaposed with, and I have to look them up because I was very unfamiliar with them. Ruins in Mexico and stuff yes. like this. So, and I guess that kind of both traditional English lit subjects and its eclecticism is around this slippery idea of waste, and also links back to your discussion of things like economics as well, because you talk a lot about that in the introduction to the book. So I guess the place to start is, could you define what waste is?
Well, the work that I set before me in writing the sort of the kind of theoretical chapters would come earlier in the book, I wanted in a way to redefine what waste is and does, to try and wrestle it away from some of the sort of familiar ways of describing what waste is. So if I could just describe what those familiar ways might be, and then try and say what I try to do with the concept of waste and how it might kind of course between these very different objects.
And these familiar ways are the kind of, I guess, the spatially
that's correct, yeah.
bounded or kind of grounded ideas.
Yeah, and very very much to do with dirt and filth and hygiene. Tremendous amount of books published in the last 30 years that relate to questions of contamination, contagion, and filth, and they're terrific and they're very interesting, but let's face it, we discard or we do not want, we reject material, both aspects of ourselves and aspects of our built environment that have nothing to do with being dirty. And likewise, there are many people all over the world that do not have this, I think, rather kind of Northern European kind of gut reaction to say shit or cum or blood or whatever. I grew up on a dairy farm in the middle of rural England, and my father would come in on a regular basis for breakfast, and I said, Dad, what's that on your forehead? He said, I don't know. I said, I think it's cow shit, Dad. Why don't you take that off before you have breakfast? I said, yeah, good idea. And I think that there are lots of people around, you know, who don't have the power necessarily or the desire to organize their worlds into clean allotments of space. It seems to me that dirt isn't very useful as a definition of what waste is. Now, my kind of theoretical intervention into the concept of waste was to try and bring time in. Now, for me, we can't have concepts of waste without also bringing in time, without also trying to describe what time is and does, and also responding to how our physical environment kind of makes time.
Yes.
How we mark and measure our operations, our desires, our projects with this stuff that we surround ourselves with, and maybe it fails, but maybe it just comes to some completion. We eat the banana, we peel the banana, we eat the banana, and we're left with this yellowy stuff. Well, we could do things with it. We could make art with it,
yeah.
Or we could not. We think in terms of processes, and those processes, for me, are very temporal, and they're very much to do with the way in which we tell stories. So in a way, what I try and unfold in those first chapters and then through the case studies that dominate the rest of the book is to try and describe how narrative and time enclose one another around descriptions of our engagement with certain things or certain assemblages of things.
Because narrative actually is a crucial almost kind of device you use, you know, you kind of insist on its importance. And it struck me as being in the current situation we find ourselves where there are kind of big questions about the role of humanities, these kind of things. It struck me that narrative was something that you were juxtaposing against kind of political economy or these, I guess, more sort of social scientifically influenced ways of thinking about waste.
Well, that you know, should we say in a kind of crude sense, you know, statistical analyses produce, you know, data and evidence that often then need to be interpreted into stories
and yeah.
They made sense of, and sometimes they're produced from kind of people's storytelling kind of habits, and then they produce data that then need to be interpreted. So narrative here, at least in my book, and I'm aware that it is almost all things. And that's something to be suspicious of. I'm suspicious of it. And I make narrative something very close to thought, but without necessarily just being thinking. We learn how to tell stories. We become experts in storytelling. We are trained to tell certain kinds of stories and tell them well or tell them badly to deceive people. But this question of narrative is something that kind of binds the book together. It is something that comes out of perhaps my more formal training in literary analysis and interpretation. It's also something that is supported by the social sciences, especially by new studies in sciences of mind. There's a tremendous literature in more analytic forms of philosophy on the importance of narrative for selfhood. It's a big debate. It's not something that I adhere to too strongly as a debate, but it's in the ether. You find it very much in conferences that are trying to compare very disparate subjects or objects. I often find that storytelling, narrative, the reproduction of stories, translation and adaptation into different media is sort of there, even if it's not necessarily made explicit. So I wanted to be kind of upfront
the
way that I wanted to use narrative to, as a sort of guiding device and also as a discussion point vis-a-vis matter, things, and time.
I mean, it's interesting that kind of those two important points about the book, about narratives and time. And I think this ties into one of the major theorists who were very interested, which is Martin Heidegger, who obviously, you know, is very famous for his work on time, and, you know, time as having a whole range of roles in his work. And what sort of role did, because he's amongst one of many theorists you touch on, but what sort of role did his idea of time in the book?
He enters into the second chapter where I want to do some more focused work on analysing the moment at which we realise waste has occurred. And, you know, and many Heideggerians will know this, and many non-philosophers will know, it's become a sort of primal scene for thinking about matter and material, and also finitude and the history of existentialism and phenomenology. This question of the broken tool analysis. Yes. And there's Heidegger doing his imagining the use of a tool, and then the tool breaks, and what that reveals is the what he calls the contexture of the world, the greater network of objects and environments that are supporting this focused activity, that the object kind of recedes from view until it fails.
Yeah.
Now, that seems a very pertinent to the discussion of waste, and yet it seemed to follow a particular story. Use the object no longer works, light up. All the references, referential, contextual of the environment, whatever you might want to say. That is, and I thought to myself, well, you know, and it's a simple objection, and many people, other people have made it. Well, it depends on what kind of hammering you're doing, what kind of hammer you have.
Yeah.
Your expectations, the projection of the successful work of the hammer depends on all sorts of things. And it relates back to what I was saying earlier about us being highly trained in storytelling, and storytelling with objects. Now, I know this is maybe perhaps a more kind of controversial side of my argument, which is to say that the stories don't just kind of happen in our heads, and that we, you know, just dump them out in language. No, we formulate our sense of events, times, durations, projects with these concerted and skilled dealings with things. And that's a particular, the hammering tool experiment is one amongst a number of other sort of thought experiments that I examine. So yes, absolutely, Heidegger is very important. I like to think that he gives me one version of how waste might come to be, and there are others that I like to discuss elsewhere.
I mean, one of the ways I think it sort of stood out to me was in kind of some of the language you were using. So some of the ideas early on in the book are around things like use time and waste time, and I think you give a really clear indication of what you're talking about here with the kind of the story about the shoes.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, listeners can read it for themselves, but it might be interesting to kind of explore use time through that story of the shoes.
Yeah, that's right. Kind of slightly ridiculous idea, but I wanted to take, having done some sort of theoretical descriptions of radio about what I want the book to do, I wanted to give a sort of example. So I take this example of having a pair of shoes, and I want to, at that moment, try and describe what I call in the book use time, to try and distinguish how use has a different temporality to waste. Now, using things, when I take up a pair of shoes, I do kind of, we enter into a kind of contract, these shoes. I mean, people talk to themselves. I don't talk to my shoes, but if I was, I'd say, right, mate, right, here we go. Right, you and I, we're going to go and do something. For instance, I'm a runner. When I pick up my running shoes, I want them to do what I want them to do. And in a way, because they're built in a certain way, they're crafted with a certain understanding of what I expect of them, they kind of have this affordance for that particular expectation. So we have this sort of dialogue. When I'm running down the street, I can feel that give and take. In the end, whether it's a single run or 1,000 runs or whatever it is, those shoes are going somewhere. They are in this sort of bounded relationship to time. They have affinitude. They're orientated towards this particular project. They have an end in terms of use and design. They have an end in terms of time. What happens then when my shoes fail? Well, that's a bit like, you know, Heidegger's hammer. Well, you know, we may enter into a different kind of temporal relationship with these shoes. So I no longer think of them as having this sort of bounded relationship to time. And yet, they also seem to speak of all the potential uses that they no longer have. So they're kind of, I use the phrase, they're things that have come to be by having been. You know, they're kind of redundant but still lingering on. And one of the things I really wanted to insist on when it came to this sort of rather kind of phenomenological, I suppose, description of shoes was to say, well, what if I never use them?
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't use shoes. It's not something that's, you know, maybe in a certain decadent way, but let's not think about shoes. What about a bunch of nails? You know, we buy some nails to do some hardware, you know, to do some hammering. What about that? We never talk about the nails in this thought experiment, only about the hammer. Well, we may have some leftovers and we're not going to use them. We know we don't want to use them. They're redundant. They're obsolete. They're waste. And yet they haven't actually entered into this kind of convoluted story of use and projection and use time.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet they've entered into this more not necessarily more dynamic, but more convolved, more mixed. They have a past, but their past isn't what their future could have been. They are temporally mixed. And the definition that I give for waste objects is this sense of being mixed up in time. They're neither for something, they're not necessarily late, retarded, or, you know, redundant. They can still be used as nails, but they're waste to me. So it's dealing with that that sense of temporal confusion that I think marks waste becoming as a category. Now, what that offers me as a sort of mobile set of coordinates, you know, use time on the one hand, waste time on the other, is a sense of sort of a structuring. A structure that we work through, and I try then and apply those concepts to art objects, to literary works, to build ruins or follies or buildings that have been destroyed for whatever reason, and they're porous and they are reversible. You know, one can take those old pair of shoes and use them for something. You know, string them up as an art object or give them away to someone else, keep them as a memento of all those runs that you've ever done. This is the sort of thing that I'm working through. They might crisscross in and out of use time, waste time. These are not didactic kind of categories, and they have a very, very complex relationship with one another. But yeah, that's really where I'm getting into that.
I suppose it's almost the kind of final moments of the introduction where you set forward one of the last kind of destabilizations of these both sets of literature and ideas about waste that you're aiming to take on in the later parts of the book. You know, so we have that sense of waste is not spatial, it's temporal as well.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, waste must be thought of as being not just about I've used something, once I finish using it, therefore it becomes waste automatically.
It's not automatically with consumption. Yeah. A lot of studies of trash and rubbish one cannot think of waste in contemporary times without thinking of capitalist consumption.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, is capitalism ubiquitous all over the globe? Do we, every time we take up with an object, are we only engaging with its use exchange value and so on? I mean, has waste existed as we know it prior to, I don't know, whatever you want to cast, time you want to cast as the emergence of capitalism?
Yeah, because you talk about the history of the word, you know, goes back to sort of Old English almost.
Yes.
It's, you know, it has a much longer history of usage than just being as, I suppose, garbage would be the other term that's important to the kind of academic studies that you're critiquing then.
Yeah, waste. I mean, maybe this is another way in which I've tried to cast waste in a new light, is to try and take waste and stay with the word waste. So there are other people who are interested in, they call it discard studies or trash theory or garbage studies. And I think fine, you know, we take our different words and they have different uses. I think, but waste seems to me particularly interesting. It's the word that that the early parts of the Bible, when translated into English, it was the word, the earth was described as waste and void, not trashed and void or rubbished and void, but waste. The sense that waste can come is a condition that comes prior to and after a particular particular process, but also waste from the Latin vastus, you know, which shares a root with vast. You know, it gives me at least a sense of something deterritorialized, something that is not located in particular spaces or places, but is, you know, let's face it, our entire earth is running down in energy. The sun is only going to burn for so long. We're in a state of entropic decline. I want to be able to have a subject and an object that describes both the process and the singularity, both a process that courses through many, many different centuries, but also describes a particular event or a particular encounter.
So how does all of this come together then in the rest of the book, where you use, you know, a quite eclectic range of examples from, you know, discarded manuscripts for Ulysses to sheds that have been blown up, and then to paintings or etchings of the Bank of England being built as a ruin before it has actually been constructed. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, you have the kind of the work on sculptures, the work on literature, and then the work on architecture. Maybe if we could take them in turn. So you give examples from Cornelia Parker's work, and then Mark Dion's sort of archaeological artistic intervention with the Tate.
Yes, I maybe rather conservative in me, but I wanted to take two artists there who had used what I consider waste material and used them kind of with quite some focus, and without necessarily trying to insert themselves into a sort of art history of sort of found objects or ready-mades. Although, of course, they're sort of readily inserted into that art history. They seem to be working with waste material to do something new with it. One of the things I was struck by as I was writing the book was that waste is novel to us. It's something that is all around us all the time. We walk down the street, I'm actually looking in this room now, and I got the leftovers of lunch, and I got to see this newspaper kind of in the corner. And it's that waste things can be kind of pointed at all over the place, and yet it can be incredibly novel to us. And it doesn't matter, we don't have to sort of really transform ourselves, or, you know, in sort of any great kind of way to sort of find waste kind of fascinating. Who smoked that cigarette before it became a cigarette butt on the street? You know, what's that doing there? Why is that bicycle being thrown in that canal? And so on. You know, we can always ask questions and of things, you know, on the street or in our houses. But then we come to an art gallery and that novelty is still there, and it's both drawn on and sort of worked with. And Dion and Parker, they're both working with a sort of set of expectations, a sort of energies, if I can be kind of obscure for a moment, kind of a set of energies that are already in the material as waste. And I was really interested in something that Cornelia Parker said about her work, which is that she works with cliches. She works with work that already has a certain set of ideas kind of attached to it, such as, you know, the idea of the garden shed, you know, place of refuge, of storage, of private contemplation, or whatever. And she literally explodes them. She then lets that debris held on a very delicately held string in a tape collection, which is just such a fabulous and well-known piece of work.
Yeah.
And she says that she that the work always seems to be doing something for her. She's just simply rearranging these objects. The objects are doing the legwork, which seems fascinating to me, particularly when it comes to waste, where legwork, you know, is sort of they're kind of run down, if you can excuse that. Diane, you know, he did this sort of archaeological digs on the Thames, and he found all this stuff that had comes to those riverbanks in whatever way, you know, through the flow, river flow, and its particular kind of tidal process and mechanism there in the Thames. But also, you know, you find in the cabinet where he then stores all this work, credit cards,
yeah,
ID cards, and messages in bottles, and it's an extraordinary kind of cabinet of curiosities that stores and contains waste. In both cases, I wanted to stress that these objects are both objects to which inspire stories, i.e., whose message is that, you know, who cast that bottle into the river for it to be found as well, and what kind of shed, who shed, what did the British Army think who helped to explode the shed? You know, they're provocations towards story, but then story seems to be already interlaced into it. And that's partly because we have this sense of a differential in time. You know, these things are no longer kind of for what they were for somehow. But they persist, and we can recognize them. Here are the shards of pottery. When I went to Tate Britain with my grandmother, who's an art historian, she could pick out the different potteries by the maker's mark and the kind of particular pattern. She said, oh, that's that, and that's that. And for me, you know, opening this drawer and looking at the shards, they're just shards,
yeah,
colourful, you know, he's arranged them according to colour. But, you know, different people have different stories to tell, but the stories are sort of already laid in the work, in the objects, in the material of the object.
But this idea about sort of time and potential and what objects are kind of carrying with them, but then what they possibly might be in the future, the previous stories and their new stories, obviously has a connection to the discussion of the works of literature in the book. But it's also quite interesting how this plays out in architecture, because your two chapters on architecture, which are very interested in particular interested in ruins, are not sort of meditations on the built environment, but capture both real places and spaces as well as more kind of architectural theory. So how do these ideas about time and waste play out in architecture?
Well, it becomes rather... I mean, it's not formulaic kind of attachment or reading of these sort of concepts of use time and waste time into sort of built environment and landscape and in buildings. It's where the kind of these ideas really get tested out. They get tested out in a different medium in sculpture, literature, in architecture. In those architectural chapters towards the end, the arguments, as I set them up at the beginning of the book, they get frayed and they get strained. And I like that. I want to see the undoing of the concept of waste itself. And in the end, with the final chapter is about kind of thinking about future ruin, about imagining spaces that may be lived in currently, but may not. May in the future be uninhabitable for whatever reason, and I kind of collect lots and lots of different examples from film, from fantasy and science fiction literature, and also from architects and their own attempts to imagine their buildings in states of future states of dilapidation and ruins. both a sort of consummation of their architectural project and also as a sort of horrific warning to those who have, you know, custody over certain cities or certain buildings in those cities. And where we end up is with a story relatively well known by Richard Jefferies called After London. And there, a traveller, sort of future, it's sort of in that sort of H.G. Wellesian kind of frame of sort of early science fiction drama, I suppose. And Felix goes in search of London. He's heard rumours that there was this great metropolis. And it's all sort of cast into the future where the whole of society has been cast back into sort of feudalistic, something that you've kind of recognised from sort of Game of Thrones or something. And Felix goes, a sort of young and disenchanted traveller, goes in search of London. He finds not much that he'd recognise as a city or what he'd heard of the city, but he finds a lot of dust. And it's really, it's this dustiness and this dissolution that each section of, you know, two chapters in each section, after each section, I try and bring us to a point where we're trying to understand what might be the dust of sculpture, the dust and the sort of silty kind of disappearance of literature, and likewise of architecture too. And they follow this kind of odd kind of arc, I suppose, where at the end, I want to ask the question, well, waste is not a permanent condition. We, all of us, human beings, pass into states of sort of material kind of incoherence. We become inchoate bodies, mixed bodies, dusty things, where somehow we can't recognize the passing of use time or the structural kind of complication of waste time in a particular object. It's just stuff, and it's that just stuffiness I'm really interested in. There's an extra few chapters to add on. I couldn't edit it on in this particular version of the book, but each one tries to work over, well, what would be the end of waste, and where does waste sort of disappear?
I was going to bring us back actually to Eliot and Joyce, but actually I think that question of what would be the end of waste is...
Well, it's a question, it's a similar question to what would be the end of literature.
Isn't it? It's quite an interesting one to sort of conclude on, actually.
It's to try and understand what the known unknowns are. Dust might be a kind of a useful thing, I think, when trying to mark out what we don't know.
Is this where you're going next, or are you doing something sort of completely different in your medical humanities work?
Yeah,
are you carrying these themes on, or?
Yeah, I think one of the unexpected things about publishing the book was that, and thank you very much for doing this, actually, people read it. And then I don't know why it comes as a surprise, but it does. I'm surprised that people read it. And that then I get invitations to do interviews like this, which is great, and it keeps the whole project alive. And I'm still thinking very deeply about the set of problems that I raise in the book, but actually no, I joined Durham a few years ago, and I joined their Centre for Medical Humanities, and that was to begin a project on human twinning. And it's a project, and I'm taking a kind of, again, to go back to sort of something I said earlier about trying to follow objects into objects of study wherever they might go, and so I'm trying to chase twins into wherever they've been or they're going, and that means that I'm doing a lot of work on the history and philosophy of biology, particularly I work quite closely with a genetics lab based in London, and I'm very interested in molecular biology. And what was unexpected when I began with this sort of new work on twins is that I'm coming back to things, but I'm coming back to a set of things that I didn't really write about, which are perhaps more kind of human things, particularly amino acids, structures of proteins, and that kind of more molecular view of what we might be or how we might work, and the substrates that have become so important to the way in which many people across the social science humanities are turning their gaze towards, well, you know, what is the molecular basis? Shall we talk of bases anymore? Or do we need to move towards a more structural or complex systems analysis of our bodies and our behaviors? Twins have always, I have to qualify this, they've been, they're present in Greek myth and religion, equally in African traditional worldviews and creation myths and stories. That's where the story begins. But they have also taken majority stakes in the history of genetics and eugenics, and now molecular genetics and behavioral genetics. And there are about 1.5 million twins enrolled in formal research programs worldwide. Twin studies is big business, and I'm interested in the way in which twins are recruited into these projects. So that was a long answer. The quick answer is not really.
Not really.
Not really. They're very involved. They're very separate books. But there is an exchange, a set of principles there. One is sort of the research methodology into kind of being slightly reckless with my curiosity. And second is to do with matter and material, which doesn't seem to be going away. It seems to be increasingly influential across
Yeah, absolutely. And will that be a new book?
It is, yeah. It will be a new book. And at the moment I'm writing kind of shorter articles, but there's a book in the pipeline there, and it's going to take some time.
Of course. Great, well, I look forward to reading that. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. This episode was discussing Waste, A Philosophy of Things by William Viney. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. Thanks for listening.